Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. We begin today's show by talking about the deadly attacks on peaceful protesters in Sudan. The death toll in Sudan continues to rise after Monday's violent military crackdown on the protest camp and wider clampdown. According to the Central Committee of Sudanese Doctors, security forces have killed at least 108 people. 40 bodies were retrieved from the Nile River on Tuesday. Over 500 people have been injured. There are also widespread reports of raping, looting, and beatings by government forces. This comes after months of protests against Omar al-Bashir, an authoritarian who has ruled the country for 30 years. In April, he was overthrown and Sudan's military took over. At that time, protesters rejected the military takeover and vowed to stay on the streets until their demands are met. Joining us to talk about the latest and media coverage is Ismael Kushkush, an independent journalist who has written for a number of publications, including the New York Times, CNN, and Al Jazeera English. Hi, Ismael. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You have friends and family in Khartoum, and you've been tweeting about this consistently. What are you hearing from people who are still there? We are hearing that people are afraid to leave their homes because armed militias are roaming the streets, terrorizing people both on foot and on military trucks. What are you hearing?
Right. Rapid support forces, formerly known as the Janjaweed, have been roaming the capital, Khartoum. We are hearing that there have been calls to bring out people. People are afraid to leave. It seems, if you look at it from one angle, that there is an attempt to drag people into violence, to give an excuse for the security forces to clamp down. Things are not very clear. The internet connections, the internet have been cut off. It's slowly returning, but it's still not reliable. There have been calls for a general strike, so things are unclear. You're not sure if people are responding to the calls for the strike, or if there is genuine fear, at least in some areas, of the rapid support forces attacking civilians.
And can you give us some context here? We have been covering Sudan for many months, and the media caught onto this story a bit late. But once they did, the reporting was very good. I mean, there were videos of so many women on the streets of Sudan. A lot of people were learning about just what it was like to live under this authoritarian for 30 years. And then all of a sudden, we get this violent, deadly military crackdown. What explains the sudden change?
Well, many believe that the ruling military council, has close ties with some of the counter-revolutionary governments, so to speak, in Abu Dhabi and in Riyadh and in Cairo, and the clampdown on the Sidon, and the Sidon being really the major card in the hands of the opposition, that came after visits by the two top leaders in the military council to those capitals. So on the very last day of Ramadan, just before Eid, before the time when Sudanese celebrate, at the time when many go out to visit their families, you have this attack where over 100 people are reported have been killed. So some see this as an attempt by the military council to rearrange how negotiations between it and the opposition were taking place. The opposition had the Sidon as its major negotiating card, and Sidon is no longer there.
I want to ask you about a piece that just ran in The Guardian by Simon Tisdall called Sudan, How Arab Autocrats Conspire to Thwart Reformists' Hopes. And he writes, it's probably no coincidence that the sudden violent crackdown on protesters in central Khartoum followed a series of meetings between the leaders of Sudan's military junta and autocratic Arab regimes that are actively attempting to shape the country's future. As you said, analysts say the rulers of Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, no friends to democratic governance, are acting in concert to thwart the aspirations of Sudan's reform movement. All three tried to shore up Omar al-Bashir's regime, and since he was toppled in April by popular protests, they have conspired to foment a counter-revolution. This fateful turning point may now have arrived.
I absolutely agree with what Simon wrote. I think governments in Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt want to see another Egypt, another Libya, and another Yemen after the revolutions in those countries. They were met by violence, by the establishment of new dictatorships. The dream of truly democratic governments in the region have been fought by those very same forces that you mentioned. I think Sudanese protests were very aware of this in the very beginning, and even after the fall of Bashir, when Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates offered economic assistance, many protesters on the ground rejected that assistance, did not want anything to do with those governments. But I think we see what happened, and it's very likely, yes, that those governments in some way or the other have been involved in strengthening the military council that rules in Sudan today.
Tisdale also reports that General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, known as Hemedti, head of the paramilitary rapid support forces that reportedly spearheaded Monday's crackdown, went to Jeddah to meet Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince. Sudan's military has very strong ties to Gulf monarchies, having assisted in the Saudi war in Yemen. Delgado said, quote, Sudan stands with the kingdom against all threats and attacks from Iran and the Houthis. So can you tell us a little bit more about these connections?
Right. So Hemedti, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo's nickname, was the leader of the rapid support forces, is the leader who fought in Darfur under the name of the Janjaweed, or who are basically tribal militias. They had contributed forces to assist the Saudis in the war in Yemen. Many are, young teenagers from tribes that have been, affected by the conflict in Darfur. That after the cooling of that conflict, to some degree, had no other work but to continue, to do what they do best, and that is to fight. So they were sent in to Yemen, and Hemedti's close ties to the governments of UAE and Saudi Arabia, are clearly continued. And those governments want to see someone like him to have the political influence in Sudan. And to continue with the type of governments that we saw after the Arab Spring revolutions in such as Egypt, and that's exactly what we were seeing right now playing out in Sudan.
Today we're speaking with Ismail Kushkush, an independent journalist who has written for a number of publications, including the New York Times, CNN, and Al Jazeera English, and we are talking about the violent and deadly attacks on peaceful protesters in Sudan. We're discussing media coverage and the latest. Let's talk a little bit more, Ismail, about the rapid support forces who are responsible for this bloodshed. So as you say, they have roots in the Janjaweed militias, which were called the Men with No Mercy by Human Rights Watch for their cruelty in Darfur. What else do we need to know about them, and how did they end up in Khartoum as part of the official security and military apparatus?
So I think there are a number of angles to approach this. The conflict in Darfur, when it broke out in the early 2000s, started between herdsmen and farmers, herdsmen mostly belonging to Arabic-speaking tribes, who were landless, who because of the environmental factors and the increased desertification were moving into lands owned by farmers who normally were of non-Arabic-speaking groups. And that's how, that is the initial spark of the conflict in Darfur. When the conflict took on a political format between rebels who representing the region against the central government in Khartoum under Bashir supported militias, tribal militias belonging to those very same nomadic groups and became known colloquially as the Janjaweed. In many ways, they are the underrepresented, quote unquote, deplorables of that region, and inflicted great harm, killings in the conflict in Darfur. After the conflict, I mean, Darfur today is still in a no peace, no war situation, but with many. Have not knowing anything else but to be a soldier, they've been used by the central government as a paramilitary force that Bashir used to balance the powers of the various security forces in Sudan. So you have the official army, you have the police, you have the national intelligence services, and you have this officialization of a tribal paramilitary and the renaming and rebranding of the Janjaweed to be known as the Rapid Support Forces. These were not the typical soldiers who were trained through academies. These were tribal militias, and Bashir had used these them to balance the powers of the various security forces in what he had called the Sudanese Security Council, in some way to prevent what he thought was a coup. That, of course, changed in April of this year. But the Rapid Support Forces were among the best equipped and to have the best funding. And at the moment, they parallel, they compete with the army itself. And opposition forces have been very critical of the establishment of the role that they have been playing in Sudanese politics.
Ismael Kushkush is an independent journalist. We're talking about what is happening in Sudan. He will be with us for about 10 more minutes. So if you have any questions or comments for him, what do you make of the media coverage? This started getting international attention finally just a couple of weeks ago, or months ago, I should say. And now, of course, with this brutal, horrific, violent crackdown, it's getting a lot of attention. What are your thoughts on the media coverage? What questions do you have? If you have any connections to Sudan, what are you hearing from friends and loved ones on the ground there? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Can you talk about the state of journalists in Sudan, Ismael? We were getting reports that foreign reporters are not being allowed to actually leave their hotels. Do you know if that's true?
Yes, I actually spoke to a colleague in one of the hotels that is known to host foreign correspondents on the day of the massacre last Monday. They were not allowed to leave the hotel. I mean, that has continued, that they were not able to contact people to see what happened. And that also goes for local journalists. People were not, journalists were not able to go to the site of the sit-in to exactly evaluate and see what had occurred.
What are you hearing from local journalists on the ground?
I think the biggest threat is to camera persons. Anyone with a large camera is almost immediately targeted by security forces. Much of the videos that we've seen in the past few days has mostly come from citizen journalists from those who are able to go, but to have professional journalists visit the sites to interview average citizens, that they become targets in themselves.
Sudan is the third largest country in Africa with a population of just over 40 million people. So we know what's happening in Khartoum, the deadly violence there. What is happening in other cities? Because, you know, our host of Cross Currents here at KALW, Hanna Baba, is from Sudan. And so she's been on our show many times talking about what's happening on the ground. She was there over the holidays visiting her family. And she said, you know, what they saw, and I'm sure you can agree to this, was just unprecedented. I mean, she said that there were protests in so many countries across, cities across the country. So are we seeing this kind of violent crackdown in other cities?
Yes, there have been protests in other cities, but we have not been able to evaluate the type of response because journalists either that are based in Khartoum have not been able to go to these cities. Internet connection has been disturbed. I think here and there we're hearing small things. So we know that there have been protests in Zarinji, which is a town in Darfur, in Agbara, in Al-Ghadarif. But we don't have a clear picture of exactly what has happened in those cities.
And so at this point, according to the Central Committee of Sudanese Doctors, these forces have killed at least 108 people. 40 bodies were retrieved from the Nile River on Tuesday. The BBC and other outlets got their hands on video showing that. Over 500 people have been injured. There are reports of tents being torched. As you said, internet is slowly coming back. There's also reports of security forces committing multiple sexual assaults, beating up medical staff and volunteers at clinics, looting and destroying property in hospitals, and threatening doctors and medical workers if they provide care to the wounded. Has this all been verified?
Yes. On the ground, doctors who have been in contact with various groups outside of Sudan have verified that there have been cases of rape. When the security forces entered the site of the sit-in, they had committed acts of rape, of burning the site of the sit-in, burning the tents that hosted cultural and political activities mm-hmm. there. There have been some looting, and then bodies have been retrieved from the Nile. We've seen many videos of bodies coming out of the river. What we know so far is that the number is 40. It might even be more.
Wow. And I was just looking this up. The New York Times back in February had a piece called Sexual Violence on the Rise in Sudan. And it starts by saying some women were tied to trees, raped for hours, and then beaten. Others who resisted were pummeled with sticks and wires. The assailants were armed men, mostly from forces aligned with South Sudan's government. I mean, we've done shows about this, but, you know, the one thing that Hanna, when she was speaking with us, was talking about was just the brutality that people in Sudan have lived under for so long. Can you talk more about that, Ismail?
For the past 30 years, I mean, conflicts in different parts of the country. I believe that report was specific to South Sudan, but we've seen in the marginal areas of Sudan, in Darfur and the Nuba Mountains and Blue Nile, and then of course also in neighboring South Sudan, very brutal ways of suppressing dissent. The only difference that is today is that this has happened in Khartoum. Mm. This is something that the people of Khartoum were not used to, but this has been going on in different parts of the country for some time now.
Ismail Kushkush is an independent journalist. We're talking about what is happening in Sudan. And let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for a good program, as usual. I have a quick question. What's the role being played by al-Sisi, the dictator of Egypt, in all of this, and also the role being played by the Saudis? That's all I have.
Right. So the as I mentioned earlier, that the governments of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have been supporters of have been clearly against any genuine democratic transformation in the region, and we saw them support the political forces that established someone like Abdel Fattah al-Sisi in Egypt and Haftar in Libya. I think Egypt, historically has its own interest in Sudan, next to the current Egyptian government being an ally of Riyadh and Abu Dhabi. It has its own interest, and it has strengthened its position by being, by Sisi currently being the chair of the African Union. After the fall of Bashir, one of the first regional meetings on Sudan was held in Cairo the scrunt of the opposition forces, knowing that what kinds of influence might come from Cairo. So this is something that many people are very wary of, to see Sisi and then Mohammed bin Salman and Mohammed bin Zayed playing a big role in what is happening in Sudan.
And according to The Guardian, Egypt has already given the junta significant assistance, using its regional influence to rally support. The African Union, which Egypt currently chairs, set a 15-day deadline for the military to hand over power when Bashir fell. But after Sisi intervened, the deadline was extended to 3 months.
Yes, and that happened initially. And the African Union yesterday suspended Sudan's place in the African Union, but I think it's still early to tell what route the AU will be taking. It has come out in the past strongly against military coups in many African countries, but then sidelined and retracted slowly. So I think we'll have to wait and see in the coming weeks what the AU's position will be.
What are you hearing from people on the ground, Ismail? The Sudanese Professionals Association, which is an umbrella group of union groups that has been behind months of the rallies and also behind the effort to oust al-Bashir, urged people to paralyze public life by blocking main roads and bridges in response to this violent crackdown. They wrote on their Facebook page just yesterday, quote, "Our success depends on our full adherence to peaceful protests, no matter how hard the criminal militias seek to drag us into violence," end quote.
Right, so the Freedom and Change Forces was meeting today with an envoy, the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, and we refused to meet with the Military Council in the Republican Palace. We met with him in the Ethiopian Embassy. It seems that talks might at some point come back to the table, but we'll wait and see. I think the opposition has lost a strong card with the sit-in. It's a matter of time to see if people will be back on the streets or start a new sit-in. The shock of what happened on Monday was very strong, I think, and I think it might be a few days till people are able to recover. The images were just powerful and painful, and for this to happen, like I said, on the very last day of Ramadan, the very first day of Eid, I think has had an impact. Whether this be the Sudanese on the ground or the Sudanese in the diaspora, this was a very sad Eid for many.
Mm. Well, Ismail, thank you so much for your reporting. Thank you for joining us, and we would love to have you back. And we hope that your friends and family in Sudan stay safe.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ismail Kushkush is an independent journalist who has written for a number of publications, including The New York Times and CNN. And you can find his work at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after the break, we will talk about media coverage of the Trump administration's threat to impose tariffs on Mexican imports. We'll talk about Trump's ongoing war on immigrants. And we'll talk about the Mexican government and the changes that they are making that would make it harder for migrants to enter Mexico. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call. You can call us on the telephone. You can send us an email to yourcall@klw.org. You may go to our website, yourcallradio.org. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about the Trump administration threats to impose tariffs on Mexican imports and the ongoing war on immigrants. And today we are joined by David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and author of several books, including his most recent, It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. David has been reporting on Donald Trump for decades now and is the founder and editor-in-chief of the nonprofit news service DC Report. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Well, glad to be here, Rose.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Yoan Grillo, a journalist and writer based in Mexico City. He's reported from Latin America since 2001 for a number of publications, including the New York Times and Reuters. Yoan Grillo is author of Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. Hi, Yoan. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, good to be here.
Well, it's great to have both of you. So why don't we talk about the tariffs? The Trump administration is warning that they're going to impose a 5% tariff on all Mexican goods starting on Monday if Mexico doesn't take action to curb the number of migrants crossing from Mexico to the United States. And if they do this, they say that the tariffs will go up incrementally to 25% by October. Yoan, what are you hearing? Is this just a political move to keep the base happy, or do you think this could happen?
It looks like it could happen. I mean, there's real serious concern here in Mexico that the tariffs will, you know, start on Monday. I mean, the administration is saying that. Now, it could simply be a threat, and Mexico is already responding to that threat. It has said that it will send 5,000 of a new militarized police force called the National Guard down to its southern border with Guatemala to try and halt migrants. So it really is pushing hard to try and avert this issue. But, you know, there's concern, and because President Trump is so unpredictable, you never know if these Trumps will appear on Monday or not, or if they will keep on going up or not.
Right, and Republicans say that they're threatening to block this plan. What do you think, David? Do you think this could happen?
Oh, I think this will happen unless the Republican senators are able to persuade Donald that this is not a good idea, and it's not a good idea. This is also part of basically taking back the minimal tax benefits that everybody got from the one piece of legislation Trump has gotten through Congress, his tax cut, where most of the benefits, of course, went to multinational corporations and very, very wealthy individuals. If a 5% tariff would cost Americans after a year about $17 billion in higher prices, and if he ratchets the tariff up, it would go up incrementally from there, undoing any benefits for most people from the Trump tax cut.
Yoan, what are you hearing from Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador? I mean, he came to power on a leftist populist agenda to bring jobs to people. He said that he would stand up to Trump's bullying and the insults. Based on what we know, he's been fairly silent. Is he saying much about this?
Well, he's in a very difficult position. And on that agenda, I mean, that's correct. He came with a populist agenda, you know, promising to. I mean, he said he would stand up to Trump, but a lot of it, his message in the campaigns was, I want to make it so you don't need to immigrate to the United States anymore. I want to return the wealth to your community, so you don't have to leave your home unless you want to. Now, the issue now with the migration is it's not really Mexican migration that is causing the numbers to swell. If you go back 12 years, it was Mexican migration. A lot of Mexicans working in things like the construction industry in the boom in the 2000s. But now the real numbers are Central Americans. So it's people coming from Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua, who are fleeing poverty, also fleeing a lot of violence and authoritarian governments there. And these numbers, these very large numbers of people are coming through Mexico en route to the United States. So Mexico's in this position of being between people coming from over its southern border to the United States and the United States putting pressure. Now, López Obrador, when he came into power, initially said, yeah, we'll give people humanitarian visas. We'll provide them jobs as well, even if they're coming from different countries. But he has since kind of backtracked on that. And is in a very, very tough position. You know, he's in a lot of pressure here because that 5%, although it might eventually be paid for by American consumers, you know, producers here are very scared about it. There's a lot of money at stake, and it could tip the economy here into recession in the short term.
What is the response to some of these changes in Mexico, specifically the pledge to deploy 5,000 to 6,000 National Guard troops to the area of the country's border with Guatemala?
I think a lot of mixed feelings here among people in Mexico. You know, as a lot of migrants have come through, there's been a lot of warm humanitarian responses to migrants and people giving out food and water and so forth among a lot of the intellectual, kind of leading intellectuals, actors, celebrities. There's an idea that Mexico should have a lot of solidarity with migrants from poorer countries. But it must be said there are also many people in Mexico who complain and say, well, we're struggling to provide jobs for our own people. This is really critical for us. You know, perhaps we do have to enforce our border more. So there is a mixed discussion here about migration, you know, south of the border, just as there is in the United States.
Right. And David, what do you make of the politics? Obrador dispatched his foreign minister to go to Washington, where he's been here for about 3 days, talking with a number of officials, U.S. officials, and then a large number of Mexican diplomats and trade experts are in D.C. to try to convince the administration not to do this.
Well, this would be very, very disruptive for Mexico. Under NAFTA, a whole variety of industries, but perhaps most importantly of all, the automobile and other vehicle manufacturing industries have created supply chains and factories in all three countries. And the work done in Mexico often is assembling inexpensive cars like the Chevrolet Cruze. There's very little value added assembling a car. There's a lot of jobs there, but there's no value added. The real value added in the car is in the engineering work and in creating the high heat-treated metal parts like the camshaft and the transmission. That's where most of the value is added, and we do that generally here in the United States. But if you disrupt these supply chains, then you're going to cause terrible problems on both sides of the border. And to what end? There is no policy position here except stopping people coming from Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, and a little bit from Nicaragua. And those people in many cases, and I say this as someone who's had to go to Honduras 3 times in this century, these are incredibly dangerous places in significant part because of the policies of previous administrations that have encouraged the rise of gangs. In Honduras, one of the local papers ran a cover story with a map of the city of Tegucigalpa listing each gang's territory so people knew exactly where to go or avoid. Mm. I mean, that's just a stunning development in that country. And so Mexico is a wedge being driven here with Mexico, and Mexico, for its economy, has to really find some way to deal with this tariff issue, or it's going to cause serious problems there, but it's also going to cause serious problems here.
And to that point, Johan, what David said about what is happening in Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, for example, I'm wondering what your thoughts are, given where you are in Mexico City, about the U.S. media coverage about why we're seeing so much migration. I mean, on this show, we talk regularly about U.S. foreign policy and tracing the connecting the dots, really. I mean, I was just reminded of a book when David was talking by Dana Frank called The Long Honduran Night. It traces poverty and violence in Honduras back to the U.S.-backed coup. But what do you think about how the media are or are not connecting the dots?
I mean, I think it, you know, it depends. I think some of this good stories out there, you know, it depends how much people are seeing the good stories or simply seeing kind of tweets and messages, and you know, there's obviously a variety of people in the United States. I mean, going back to that point, so I've covered Honduras a lot over the last 12 years and covered the coup in 2009, and I went there when the even when the former president Zelaya attempted to fly in an aeroplane and there was a big shooting by the airport, and covered the rise of violence since then. I think certainly that coup was a part of the gradual kind of degradation of the state of law. But I really think you really do have an issue in Central America and in Mexico and large parts of Latin America with gang violence, with the way it's become a force controlling neighborhoods, as the other guest was pointing out. And a lot of the very severe antisocial predatory crimes that are happening to people, it's not only the numbers of dead bodies, it's really what people are experiencing. I was just earlier this week in a town called Coatzacoalcos in southern Mexico, down at the train tracks where there were migrants who were going north. And I talked to one pair of cousins, 20 years old and 23-year-old young ladies with their babies. There was the 23-year-old, she had a 2-year-old and a 7-year-old baby with her. And they were jumping the trains. They said that about 2 weeks ago, there were gang members who went to their house and said, "You have to become girlfriends of the local gang. You know, you're living in this neighborhood. You have to make ourselves available to us." So it's that kind of sexual violence that exists in these places that often you can't see in the numbers, or maybe they don't go through, that people are uncomfortable about talking about sometimes. Mm. And they were on the train tracks. They were not aware. You know, I asked them, "What do you think about the Trump threat of tariffs?" They just, you know, didn't know anything about this world. It's a world that's very, very different to them. It's interesting seeing people like that with their own personal tragedies, their own stories, and these politics often very far away from those personal tragedies.
Mm. It's just so sad because they're getting hit from so many sides. We've had some young women on from Honduras who were victims of sexual assault, and they said, you know, "We just don't talk about it, and there are very few resources for us."
Mm. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's where is the protection from people? So I think, you know, in these places, you do have a certain failure of the governments to provide security, right, for the population. Now, the government in Honduras is very corrupt. The president's brother has been, you know, indicted on drug charges. There's talk about himself being accused of drug trafficking as well. So you have a very, very corrupt government and failing to protect its people from these gangs. Now, you know, there is a real case that these gangs like MS-13 are very violent. But in fact, they were formed in the United States and in a way exported to Central America.
Today we are speaking with Johan Grillo, journalist and writer based in Mexico City and author of Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize winning investigative reporter and the author of many books, including his most recent, It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. David is also founder and editor-in-chief of the nonprofit news service DC Report. And if you'd like to talk about media coverage of the tariffs and immigration and these changes that Mexico is embracing, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. David, I want to ask you what your thoughts are about coverage of these tariffs. Something has really struck me this week. I've been hearing on the radio, on NPR a couple of times, basically saying that a lot of these U.S. factories opened shop in the United States because of low labor costs. But that's where it ended. And so I was really curious. I'm wondering, well, how much money do people in Mexico actually make in these factories? And I found a piece from Vice. This was in March, called Thousands of Workers at U.S. Factories in Mexico Are Striking for Higher Wages. And according to this piece, people who work in factories and make car parts, washing machines, and even soda for U.S. citizens make about $2.50 an hour. And they're striking. Workers are organizing at unprecedented rates along the border in Mexico. So on average, they make about $12.50 a day. Can you talk about this?
Well, one of the principles of NAFTA, which was essentially an agreement by big business interests in all three countries that politicians then embraced, was a labor arbitrage. A stock market arbitrage is stock is selling for $1 a share in New York, but in the San Francisco Exchange, it's 95 cents. So if you can buy it in one and sell it in the other or vice versa, you can pick up a nickel. And when you're talking about a 5% difference, you can get very rich very quick, a nickel at a time. And here, what we have is American workers who were being paid $14 to $25 an hour. So the employer's viewpoint is that these workers cost $25 to $40 an hour because employers' costs are higher than just your cash wages, were replaced with very cheap labor. And it's not surprising that people in northern Mexico, where these factories have been built up over the last 25 years under NAFTA, are feeling squeezed and recognize that they have some leverage and are trying to get higher wages. This is the same problem, by the way, that China is facing with its urban classes of people who were, a generation or a generation and a half ago peasants. They're feeling very squeezed, too, and they're looking for higher pay. But even if pay were to double, it's still a huge arbitrage and savings, even including transportation costs, for American and Canadian manufacturers to send the low-value work to Mexico.
Johan, can you also talk about this? Because according to this Vox piece, the Mexican government and labor unions have controlled the workforce with an iron grip, immediately quashing labor unrest by jailing workers who go on strike. Again, these are workers who are making $12.50 a day working for major U.S. corporations. So what is changing under this new president, if anything, on this issue?
Yes. So with the issue of unions, with the when Mexico was under a one-party rule for 71 years, from 1929 to 2000, and they had what they call a corporate structure where the trade unions were kind of controlled by the government. Now, they were very powerful, and certain people like the oil unions achieved very high wages. But a lot of the jobs, like car factories, are paid very low. And I went over just during the Trump election campaign. I did a story for the New York Times and went to a car factory about an hour from Mexico City. And people, they were telling me they were making, $12, $50, $13 a day, like 250 pesos a day, working in these car factories. So quite incredibly lower than the United States. Now, I don't know if it's true that in terms of jailing people for striking. I mean, there is talk. The new president, López Obrador, has talked about making more democracy in certain trade unions. Now, let's see if he really does that, like with the oil union, where you had very corrupt union bosses for many years who have made a lot of money from their members. But it's still very, very hard to organize car workers, often on casual contracts, to really have an effect with the company and improve their pay. And the idea that when NAFTA was signed back in 94, or when it came to effect in 94, that it would kind of eventually see a leveling out, that has clearly not been the case.
And Mexico pays its workers the lowest wages in the developed world, which is a setup that these U.S. companies have encouraged. What about working conditions, Johan?
They're very mixed. Some are very bad. I mean, in the car factories, they're fairly similar to a lot of the car factories in the United States. But there are places here, some fields where there are still child labor used in some places, growing certain crops. There are some bad, like sweatshops for clothes in certain places, with very bad labor conditions still. Now, funnily enough, part of the trade deal, the renegotiation of NAFTA, encouraged by President Trump, paradoxically, in a way, did try and create better labor laws in Mexico. That was one of the things being asked for. So it's kind of, in a way, a paradox that Trump's effort to renegotiate NAFTA was resulting in some, perhaps, some improvement in labor conditions here.
David, what would you add? I mean, you're talking about people making $12.50 an hour, and if they get to the United States...
$12.50 a day.
I'm sorry, yes, $12.50 a day. And if they get to the United States, if they work for, say, a union shop, a farm, we just did a show about some of the wineries that treat people with respect, they can make that in an hour or more.
Well, in the history of the world, as far back as I've studied it, and I used to teach, as you know, the law of the ancient world, there's never been a wealthy society neighboring a poor one that has managed to keep people from coming across its borders. And the people who tend to come into the wealthy country are the strivers, although in this case a lot of them are people simply escaping horrific violence, particularly sexual violence against women. The promise of NAFTA, this claim that eventually we would see an equalization of labor rates, I thought was a joke at the time, and I think history has proven that it's a joke. Wages are likely to get a little higher in Mexico, but even if you follow Trump's idea that a percentage of the job should pay $14 an hour, there's still a huge labor arbitrage there, and it will pay American companies to send low-value work to Mexico. Mexico gets some benefit from that. It's better than not having those jobs at all, but it is also fundamentally based on keeping people down, not having them unions and organized, unless the new Mexican president actually walks his talk, and we begin to see real unions that serve the members.
Right. And what are your thoughts on that, Johan? Because Leon Krause wrote a piece in Salon called What Will It Take for Lopez Obrador to Finally Stand Up to Trump?
We'll see. He doesn't look like he wants to take a real strong position and have a confrontation with Trump. You know, his priority has always been the domestic agenda and not getting into international affairs. He sees the idea of getting into international affairs a distraction. However, you know, it's very hard to avoid fighting with Trump, and Trump does act like a bully. He pushes, and then if you give, he can push some more. So Mexico now is offering, 5,000 troops on the southern border, and still he could put the tariffs on. He could still punish further. So, perhaps at some point he will have to stand up and say, okay, we can't take... Another issue that the United States is doing, which I thought Mexico would never accept, is people who are applying for asylum in the United States, they're making them go into Mexico and wait in Mexico while their asylum claims are processed. And Obrador also capitulated on this point as well. So perhaps, tariffs going 5%, 10%, something that will push Obrador to a position where he does have to start confronting President Trump on these issues and not only capitulating on them.
Mexican officials also announced federal charges against two prominent migrant activists and financial penalties against more than two dozen people suspected of helping migrants. Do you think that he could possibly lose his base over some of these moves?
To be honest, I don't think that hitting migrants and migrant organizations will hurt his base that much. Certain people who work in like human rights organizations, people who are sympathizers to this, but his real core base probably won't be turned by this. His real core base are large numbers of poorer people in the countryside and in the cities who really believe his idea that he will change conditions in Mexico, and his approval rating is still very high among most people there. And also, I was in Veracruz recently in Coatzacoalcos and talked to a lot of people there, and there still is a large amount of support for López Obrador, despite these moves on migrants.
You know, there's been a lot of reporting about just the horrific conditions that immigrants are finding on their horrendous travels from Central America to the United States. What are the conditions like in different parts of Mexico that you have visited?
So, yes, it was some very rough conditions. Talking to the people by the train tracks, they were sleeping, because now the crackdown from federal police, and they were kind of trying to avoid federal police, they were sleeping on the mud by the train tracks. And so this is talking about a family with two women, with three children sleeping there. Very, very little food, very, very little water, very hot, sweltering weather. Going on the freight trains themselves is extremely hazardous. I cannot imagine getting on a freight train with a two-year-old kid. Very, very dangerous. But actually, the worst and most distressing conditions I've seen of migrants here were back in December in Tijuana, when a refugee camp, a big refugee camp, appeared right where you could see the United States, right in Tijuana next to San Diego. And there was one day there, basically the toilets were broken, there was feces there, and then it rained very heavily, and the feces formed into massive puddles, just a huge stench. And that was really, really horrific conditions there.
Mm. Well, we're almost out of time. Final thoughts, David K. Johnston, just in terms of the tariffs, what are your thoughts about how the media are covering the possibility of these tariffs?
Well, the coverage is not very sophisticated because most journalists don't understand tariffs, which are essentially a tax on American citizens. And underlying all of this, let's not forget that it is the Minister of Racism, Steve Miller, in the White House, who is pushing this. This policy on tariffs is really designed to foment Donald Trump's vision to make America white again. And that is at the core of all of this, and we shouldn't lose sight of that, that all of these other issues grow out of Donald Trump's hatred, lifelong hatred, for which there have been judicial proceedings that he has been found to have been discriminated against blacks, women, Asians, Puerto Ricans, and others, of people who come from south of the United States border.
Well, David, if other journalists told it like it is so clearly, I think we'd be in a better place.
One hopes.
David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and the author of several books. It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. That's one of his bestsellers. He's founder and editor-in-chief of the nonprofit news service DC Report. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Yoan Grillo is a journalist and writer based in Mexico City and is author of Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. Thank you, Yoan.
Great to be here. Anytime.
Thank you so much. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and Leah Cesarin, our intern. Thanks to Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. And you can find more information about Your Call. You can listen to past shows and sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call's Media Roundtable.